So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bearers Ask an Expert podcast. So hello, everyone, and welcome to Spirit Bearers podcast. That is P-A-W cast. Yes, you heard right, where we're bringing together experts to ask some questions about words we're hearing in child welfare and maybe in our communities and families that we've heard said a lot of times, but we want to drill down a little bit more and really understand what these things are, what the effects are on children, and if there is a challenge, how we actually can fix it and what the evidence says about that, right? So today's topic is really an important one and actually a growing one, particularly coming out of COVID-19. The number of persons who are falling into addictions because of unresolved individual and collective trauma is really, really rapidly increasing. And we see the headlines across the country about the tragedy of the increase, particularly in fentanyl addiction and deaths resulting from fentanyl. But this trail of substance misuse can be linked back to cannabis colonialism with First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples, and definitely shows up when we have the conversation about the dramatic overrepresentation of First Nations children in care. You'll remember one of my guests today, Dr. Fallon, in a previous episode, was telling us that First Nations kids are 17.2 times more likely to be in foster care than other kids. So that's what, quote, overrepresentation looks like. We're going to talk to her and two other amazing guests today, Dr. Ashley Vandermorris, who is a pediatrician at Sick Kids Hospital, and Genevieve Saison, who is a research associate at the University of Toronto, about substance misuse and how that relates to children in care and families and what we can do about it in today's conversation. But let's turn to Dr. Fallon, who is the Associate Vice President of Research at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Fallon, you have been looking at what's been happening with children in child welfare for many years now. And in a study called the Canadian Incident Study, which is where you get that figure of 17.2 times more likely, it also asks a question about what's driving all of that. So can you tell us about the role of where substance use shows up at the level of the parent and also in the latest data that you have on children from 2019?
Thank you for having us on Spirit Bears podcast. We certainly deem it as an honor and very pleased to be with you today. And I'm very pleased to be with my colleagues, Genevieve and Ashley. In the First Nations Canadian Incident Study, we see similar results to other incident studies where when we're looking at some of the caregiver functioning issues that child welfare workers note during a child welfare investigation, alcohol use really factor in disproportionately for First Nations populations. So certainly compared to investigations of non-Indigenous children, about a third of investigations for First Nations parent, there is a substance use issue noted by the child protection worker that can involve either alcohol use or drug use. When we look at neglect investigations specifically, we see a higher proportion of investigations that the worker has a concern around the neglect of children that involved either alcohol use or drug use for a First Nations parent. So certainly the impact of colonialism and the relationship to substance use is really evident in the child protection system and is pretty consistent across the incident studies.
Now, Dr. Fallon, there's a lot of big range in what could be thrown into the bucket of substance use. I might be a parent who smokes a bit of weed once a week, and I might be put in that category along with somebody else who's severely addicted to fentanyl. So does the CIS study, the Canadian Institute study you're talking about, talk about where people are on that range, or does it just rely on what the social worker thinks might be happening in my family?
That's a great point. And certainly it does rely on the clinical judgment of the social worker who has met with the family, with the child, you know, probably one time, sometimes two times, maybe three times. And the worker is asked to consider whether or not substance use is an issue for this caregiver in the past 6 months. So there is a lot of ambiguity into the question and a lot of room for biases to seep into the answer. Absolutely.
What do we know, Genevieve, about any kind of bias that might come into that decision-making process? So if I am a social worker and I'm walking into a white family with the same facts as a First Nations family, am I completely devoid of any kind of bias walking into that assessment about whether that parent has substance misuse? Or am I just, even if I'm trying to do my job, but I've got this implicit bias, am I more likely to say, yeah, I'll check off the box of substance misuse for a First Nations, Métis, or Inuit parent than another parent? Do we know anything about that in the research?
I think, Cindy, I mean, it's both, right? So we have no way of determining the kinds of biases that a child protection worker would use to endorse that the caregiver has a substance use issue in the past 6 months. And it probably is likely that, you know, they're picking up that thread from the last clinical judgment. So we know that families in all child protection investigations, particularly for First Nations children, have been identified previously. So they're probably picking up a clinical interpretation from their file review as they meet with families about a new concern. And we're really unclear as to how, you know, we can interrogate the veracity of that endorsement. At a population level, there is certainly a disproportionate burden of substance use disorders in First Nation, Métis, and Inuit populations as a result of colonialism. But separating out the kind of inherent racism of the child welfare system for First Nations children and families and the veracity of the claim, I think is a big challenge.
This is really capturing for me what the complexities are around this. We know that because of residential schools, the collective and individual trauma, First Nations parents are more likely to resort to substance misuse as a way of trying to cope with that pain, especially given the inequalities and the lacks of culturally relevant mental health supports that are out there. Dr. Vandermoor, is one of the things that you must encounter in your practice is when we hear the word substance misuse in parenting, it can kind of feel like it's one category. But what do we know about where it is on the continuum of substance misuse that really impacts that parent's ability to safely care for the child? And how should we be taking that into account in our work in child welfare?
Cindy, it's a great question. And I don't know that I have an entirely satisfactory answer because I actually don't know that exact question has been studied, despite the fact that I think it's very much the true question, right? There is somewhere between occasional substance use and, you know, daily repeated reliance on using substances to the point of not being able to sort of make safe or appropriate judgments that, you know, is likely the place where an individual's ability to parent may be compromised. But I don't think we have research on how to appraise that or repeatedly appraise that. So we don't sort of see someone at one moment in time and make determinations in a static way rather than in a dynamic way. You know, so I don't know that I have an answer to your specific question. What I do think it brings up really importantly is the notion of harm reduction and the importance of recognizing that there are ways to promote safety and optimize a parent's ability to care for their child even if they are using substances up until a point, certainly. And again, I think that is the complexity and the challenge, but that certainly there are opportunities to intervene and that, you know, abstinence, which is often touted as sort of the gold standard of addressing substance use, does not necessarily have to be the end goal for a parent in order for them to be able to sort of care for their children and provide a safe environment for their children. So there are ways to mitigate risk.
Yeah. And from your conversation, a couple of things that come to mind when people are making these professional decisions, because I think all of us in a common sense way know that we have laws about not driving and being intoxicated. Well, looking after a child is as, if not more important than driving as a benchmark. So there are real limitations to when you're becoming intoxicated, to being undertaking the very sacred work of parenting. But it seems to me a bunch of things that would come into my mind if I was assessing it would be the age of the child, whether that child has any special needs, what type of drug or drugs, plural, is the parent using? How frequently are they using those drugs? What kind of effect does that drug have on them? Is there another safe parent in that space or another safe caregiver in that space who's able to protect that child against those things? And some of the harm reduction strategies that you're talking about. We often hear with substance misuse, even in the most severe cases, we're going to send this person off to treatment. That doesn't always work very well because then the person comes back into the same situation that they were in and they have a lot of relapse. And people on this call can correct me, but I think the relapse rates are north of 80% when you do that type of treatment model. What do we know about substance use interventions? And the ones that would work for parents who are in families.
So, Cindy, I think you're asking, what does the evidence say? So there is a substantial range of literature on the topic, and there is really very limited evidence on what is effective with respect to interventions for First Nations populations. There's a few reasons. There is, as I mentioned, limited research, and with very little scientific evaluation methods that fit with First Nations cultural values and worldviews. Another challenge with evaluation of the programs for the prevention and treatment of substance use disorders is that the programs are varied. So they include residential inpatient treatment centers, community-based programs, land-based programs, and certainly that diversity, which is a good thing, but it also leads to challenge into really understanding what is the impact, what are the takeaways around what's helpful using a culturally relevant perspective. I would say that the common evidence base, though, is that we do know some things work. So we do know that programs that are community-based and founded on the knowledge and cultures of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples are ones that are demonstrated to be successful. And as Dr. Vandermore said, that a focus on harm reduction rather than abstinence, if there is a comprehensive and holistic approach to treatment that really, as you've mentioned in previous conversations, that focuses on the determinants of health, so not only on the individual, but the context surrounding that individual, that the treatment is culturally informed, that includes the impact of colonialism, so that the practice kind of incorporates cultural safety into the program. And it's really is focused on recovery oriented to prevent relapse. So we do know there's some tenets of programs that need to be in place in order to help someone who is challenged with a substance use issue.
Yeah, I think kind of following on the comments that Barbara has made. So one of the critiques of a lot of the existing treatment approaches that are out there is that they tend to follow a Western biomedical model, and this, you know, they focus on treating the individual and focusing on this end goal of complete cessation or abstinence. Whereas if we really want to support First Nations peoples with substance use disorders, they need to have treatment approaches available that better align with their own values and worldviews and approaches that incorporate these beliefs about health and wellness and healing. So, for example, we've noted in the literature that, you know, programs that might better support First Nations people with substance use issues are those that really recognize that interconnectedness between the people and the land and the natural world. Programs that allow Indigenous peoples to restore their cultural identity, that's been found to be helpful and really boost their sense of belonging and support and connection to their culture and the land, and really getting at their spiritual roots and that connection between, you know, like the body and the mind and the spirit. So these are some of the things that we found in the literature that can be helpful and effective in supporting First Nations peoples with substance use problems.
Dr. Vandermore, a lot of our community members will be familiar with the term FASD, and they also know in the general parlance, drug addicted babies. We talked in a previous episode about the importance of holistic prenatal care. Can you give us a sense of what some of the impacts are on parental substance misuse, particularly on infants, but then on the role of how prenatal care might actually be a substance use intervention before the baby even arrives on the scene?
You know, I think there's two parts to that question. I mean, I think the first part to know is that absolutely, you know, use of substances can impact a child across their developmental trajectory. Specifically for alcohol, we don't know what amount is safe and at what point it becomes unsafe. And so, you know, we really do try to support women in avoiding using alcohol during pregnancy. The flip side of not knowing that there's any safe amount is that it's never too late to cut down on use. And I think that reframing is really important for women who are pregnant. There's always an opportunity to reduce use, and that can always be a benefit to the child, whether it's their developmental trajectory due to in utero exposure to alcohol or in setting up that parent to be less reliant on alcohol when they are actually parenting. You know, so we do know that substances, you know, substance exposure during pregnancy can affect children, but we also know that it's hard to know to what extent that substance use impact on the fetus is compounded by the other contextual factors that often set women up to be more likely to use substances. So things like not having a safe place to live, having experienced trauma, having, you know, a lack of access to healthy food. So again, we don't want to think of substance use in isolation or that is the, you know, that addressing an individual's substance use is the only way to promote a healthier outcome for the parent and her child. You know, so that's sort of in terms of, sort of the considerations when a woman is using a substance during pregnancy. In terms of prenatal care as an intervention for substance use, absolutely. Again, it's, you know, as we talked about in a previous episode, you know, pregnancy can be a time of opportunity. It can be a time to really engage women in a different way, to support them in looking to the future and to envisioning how they want their future and their family's future to look, and to then bring in the supports to help them reach those goals. You know, the other piece of your question to recognize is when I was listening to Barbara and Genevieve, in terms of what the evidence says works specifically for First Nations, Inuit, MET women, I think, you know, the other challenge is not just what works, but how do we get people to what works, right? So what are the barriers to accessing those programs? And one barrier for parents specifically can be challenges around childcare or challenges around, you know, fear of losing custody of their child if they seek treatment. So really wanting to advocate for and promote substance use programs and treatment models for pregnant and parenting women that celebrate them as parents and center their relationship with their child rather than requiring them to be separated from their children. And there are those models out there. Again, there's an opportunity to sort of really study them more deeply to understand which elements of those programs are going to best support First Nation, Inuit, and Métis women, or are there different, you know, what are the core tenets, as Barbara said, where do we need to either adapt those programs or where do we need to sort of engage First Nation, Inuit, and Métis communities to build their own programs based on their own values.
And just to link it back to the beginning conversation, Cindy, in this podcast, where you asked me to comment on the child welfare investigations and the identification of substance use issues for child welfare investigations. Once a worker has identified that this may be an issue for the parent, it really would be important to have an intervention that's appropriate available for that parent. And I think that's where we fail systematically in child welfare services. We often identify issues for children, for parents, without the corresponding solution.
Yeah, you know, you're both bringing up such an important point. And in fact, a lot of, you know, and this is a challenge, when you have social workers, they can't know everything, but they're actually very rarely trained in substance misuse. And so they often have to rely on skilled professionals, but often they don't even have in the toolkit a resource to be able to address the problem. So this is kind of a scenario where you also need a multidisciplinary type of approach, right? And one of the things that I've heard a lot of parents say is the reason that they don't come forward is, first of all, they feel guilty about having a substance misuse issue. They feel badly about that. And they also worry that someone will take away their child if they come forward, or something else like that will happen. And what we need to do is create systems of care that encourage people to come forward, that don't say like, you know, like you've done all these terrible things and da, 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 but actually say it took a lot of courage to come forward in this moment. And a lot of love for your child and your family to want to do better. And even if you have a bit of a relapse, you're working towards that broader goal. We know that people relapse many times, not many times, but several times before they get to a place where they may get to sobriety or to a level of harm reduction that really supports them in their parenting. People, the key message is for folks is don't give up. You know, love yourself and love your kids enough to reach out for these supports when they're available. And thankfully, they're becoming more available over time. The barriers to access are still real, but we're starting to see some of those come down. Now, just as we wrap up this session, when we think about what are the three most important things that people should know about First Nations, children, youth and families, and substance misuse interventions. I'm going to give each one of you a closing comment here. Genevieve, we're going to begin with you. What would you say?
For me, the most important takeaway from this is that we know that substance use disorders disproportionately impact First Nations, Métis, and Inuit populations and disproportionately have negative consequences for them. And yet there's a significant level of unmet need for treatment among these populations. So we really still don't know what works and what's going to be most effective. And that's where we need to focus on, is determining how to support First Nations people with substance use disorders to really reduce the harm for them in the most effective and appropriate way.
So researchers out there, here is a study that needs to be done, right? Is to have folks look at these questions, because sometimes these things get overlooked. It's almost like women in the heart attack literature, where all the studies were based on men and no one thought about what it looked like for women. Now that's starting to change. But here we need more research on the impacts to kind of better identify substance misuse and to identify the remedies that take into account the cultures and the colonial realities of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples. Thank you for that, Genevieve. Barbara, what would you add to that?
Yeah, just to completely agree that there has to be a stronger focus on the development and implementation of treatment programs for First Nation, Métis, and Inuit populations that consider and address cultural, social, historical factors that will lead to efficacy and culturally competent services and supports, really involving two strategies. The first is to expand the educational and training opportunities for providers who identify as First Nation, Métis, and Inuit, and the second, which is to engage with the broader community around how to enhance cultural awareness and competency for healthcare providers, counselors, addiction specialists, and other workers involved in the substance use programs with First Nation, Métis, and Inuit populations.
Yeah, and Barbara, one of the things you're highlighting for me is the notion that we need to recognize that sadly, that disproportionality in substance disease also is a characteristic of some First Nations youth, where they're much more likely to be involved in substances because they've had those hardships of the multi-generational. So we have to remember that some of these programs will have to be developmentally tailored to young children in some cases and youth, because we don't want to create another barrier by just having adult treatment facilities when we really need to have ones tailored for children and youth as well. Is that a fair comment?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And Dr. Vandermorens, what would you have to say about this?
So I as always would concur with everything that Genevieve and Barbara would say. And I think the last piece is, you know, while there absolutely needs to be this enhanced focus on community-based treatment programs that are culturally safe and appropriate and research around what works, we also need to not forget that treatment programs are only one component of what's needed for a broader approach to address the real root causes of problematic substance use in First Nations, Inuit and Métis populations, you know, and that's discriminatory policies, institutional structures, you know, ongoing structural racism that have led to ongoing disparities in social determinants of health. And we need longer term solutions addressed and achieved through significant changes to health and social systems. In ways that can support healthy behaviors, and sort of thriving amongst First Nation, Inuit, and Métis communities in Canada.
And for all of our listeners, when you're in your communities and you're seeing people struggling with substance misuse issues and you're seeing children impacted by this, we don't want to leave you with the message that the answers are only in the future. There are supports that you can reach out to right now. You can do that within your nation. Look for folks who are working in the areas of drug and alcohol abuse, or people who are working with children, youth, and families, those prenatal care people, the folks in the health department, teachers who are there to also educate and support young people who are attending school, but also the important work of educating us all on the impacts of substance misuse and intervention. So we'll post some of those links along with this podcast. And we also want to say that there is a fuller paper that has been prepared about substance use interventions. So anything that we didn't capture here will be in that paper. And we're going to continue this conversation on substance use because it's such an important topic, especially today, as I began the podcast talking about the deepening trauma that many people in society felt as a result of the pandemic. And that's deepened the substance misuse issues and the impacts on kids and families. Thank you all for joining me today on this podcast. And we'll look forward to welcoming you back on future episodes because there's so much to cover in these very important topics. We'll see you back here again on Spirit Bears Podcast, where we learn from experts about what we do and do not know about various topics that touch on First Nations children, youth, and families. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bears Ask an Expert podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes.